The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. If you're a practicing Christian, this is a deeply meaningful time of year, the season of Advent and, of course, Christmas. Also, Jews are observing Hanukkah right now, a holiday focused on family and a celebration of a miracle at a desecrated temple long ago. But for a growing number of Americans, the holiday spirit has nothing to do with religion. More people than ever now identify with no particular faith. Researchers call them the unaffiliated, or the churchless, or the nuns, spelled N-O-N-E-S, reflecting their none-of-the-above responses to surveys on religious preference. But call them what you will, their numbers are huge, about 1 in 5 Americans, and they seem to be especially concentrated here in northern New England. Vermont takes the title as the nation's least religious state, and New Hampshire comes in a close second. Today in The Exchange, understanding the unaffiliated. Let's hear from you this hour. Are you part of this none-of-the-above group when it comes to religion? Why, and what's good about it, in your opinion? Also, if you're a part of a faith community, what's your reaction to the nuns? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests with us. Michelle Dillon is with us, professor of sociology, department chair at UNH. Michelle's written extensively about Catholicism and new religious trends. Michelle, welcome back. Great to have you.
Thank you, Laura. I'm happy to be here.
Also joining us from Chicago, Catherine Osment, freelance journalist, author of the Boston Magazine article, Losing Our Religion, about raising a family outside of any organized faith. Catherine's currently writing a book about the same topic. And Catherine, thank you for making time out for us today.
Thank you for having me.
Joining us from Hanover, Randall Balmer, historian, author, religion professor at Dartmouth College. He's written extensively about American religion. He's also an Episcopal priest. His latest book, by the way, is called Redeemer, The Life of Jimmy Carter. And Randall, good to have you back on The Exchange. Thanks for being here.
Nice to be back again, Laura.
Well, lots to dig into, folks. And Michelle, I wanted to start with you just for a little definition at the top, if we could. Lots of terms out there these days when you look into this topic. Nuns, like I said, for none of the above. The unaffiliated, the churchless. Who are we talking about and how big is this group?
Well, we're talking about people who, when pollsters ask them what is their religion and give them various options, including the more traditional Protestant, Catholic, or Jew, they also give the preference now of no religion. And so we've seen quite an increase in the proportion of Americans who have been saying they have no religion. It has basically tripled from the early 90s. So it used to be around 6-7%, and it's now at 20%.
Tripled since the 90s. Wow.
But I would say that even though they have no religious preference, in other words, they don't see themselves affiliated with any organized or institutionalized religion, many nonetheless still endorse belief in what we would call traditional Christian or Jewish or other religious beliefs. So it's not that they're saying that they're atheists. So this is important, I think, to know, because there's still a certain, it seems, stigma in American society for people to be atheists. That has remained pretty stable, although these organizations that are atheists have become more visible. But for the vast majority of people actually who say they're unaffiliated, many still believe in various tenets of traditional religious faith.
So, usually when we think of people with no preference, we did think of atheists and agnostics. You're saying they're part of it, Michelle, but not the only part.
Yes, yes. And I think it's really this distancing from organized or institutionalized religion, the major churches in the U.S., for example.
Well, and in a minute, I want to talk to you about why this group has tripled, as you say, since the 90s. That's real interesting. But another question for you, Randall Balmer, why are there so many unaffiliateds, if we could call them that, here in northern New England? You wrote about this recently.
I did. Well, I think there are a lot of things going on here. First of all, the
religious options here in New England. And by the way, I should also point out that the Pacific Northwest is the second least religious region of the country. I think probably some of that has to do with distractions. More and more households are dual working households. That is, both partners are working full-time. Sunday comes along and it's time to go out hiking or do something outdoors rather than head off to church. I think that's one of the factors. I think the other factor is that here in New England especially, the religious options tend to be more traditional and what would historians generally call mainline, say mainline Protestantism, for example. And these are traditions that have been around for a long time that are identified in many ways with the establishment, with the status quo. And as I travel around this neck of the woods, I find that these congregations are overwhelmingly populated with older folks in the congregation, and the younger folks simply aren't signing on to their parents' faith.
Well, it's interesting, Randall, and this is your role as a historian. I mean, as you know, New England was founded by religious people seeking religious freedom in the New World. So it's kind of crazy that we are the most unaffiliated now.
Well, it is. But I think the most difficult task for any parent, and this is really across the board, beyond Christianity, Judaism, a wonderful example of that is Chaim Potok's extraordinary novel, The Chosen. The most difficult task is passing religious faith from one generation to the next, especially in a tradition that demands some sort of conversion experience or some sort of ecstatic embrace of the faith. It's very, very difficult. And this is actually one of the books that some years ago I thought about writing and never got around to, but one of these days perhaps I'll get back to it. But that, and the Puritans are a wonderful example of that. What happened in 17th century New England is that the Puritans came over in the 1630s in this heroic quest for religious freedom, or at least for themselves, not for anybody else. And what happened was that the second generation simply could not appropriate the faith of their parents. And by the end of the 17th century, the Puritan experiment was really in shambles.
Wow. So even early on, people had a hard time passing on the religious enthusiasm to their children.
Yes, absolutely.
That's fascinating. And Catherine, this is right up your alley. In your article and in your forthcoming book, you talk about two of the themes that Randall just brought up. One being just the time crunch. People are busy. Both parents are working. You write about your husband's Sunday morning baseball game and your Sunday morning yoga class. And
right.
It just seems like an easier, better option.
I do think parents are more pressured than ever, and there's a lot of pressure on parents to get their kids to activities. There's a lot going on the weekends. And people I interview say, you know, I'm just tired on Sunday. It has already been a crazy busy week. We've had a lot on Saturday, and sometimes people just want to retreat into their newspaper and morning coffee. And I think if religion were really drawing them, that wouldn't be such an issue. I think if there were something about religion that was really resonating for people, they would probably overcome that, as people have and do. But for some reason, there is this group of people for whom, you know, the yoga class, maybe that becomes the religion, you know, or something else becomes the thing that they use as their time away from the busyness of life.
Their spiritual outlet, so to speak.
I would say so, yeah.
And you have a great story in your article, Catherine, about how your own examination of this began. It relates again to this idea of passing on or not passing on religion to your kids. You lived in Cambridge at the time. You're in Chicago mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. You lived near a Greek Orthodox church. They were having a procession one day, and your kids were pretty curious. What happened?
Yeah, so my son, the others were asleep, but my son was about 8 or 9 at the time, and he was looking out the window. It was Good Friday, and the church was directly across the street from us, and every year they literally would shut down the street and have this amazing, beautiful procession, candlelit, you know, around 10 o'clock at night, and they would carry this platform with decorated in flowers and a replica of the baby Jesus on it, singing, and, you know, directly in front of our window, the priest stops and reads a prayer, and everyone sings in response. And my son is like, Mom, you know, look at this. What is that? And I said, well, they're celebrating Good Friday. And he said, well, you know, why don't we do that? And I said, because we're not Greek Orthodox. And he said, well, what are we? And it stopped me short. The question stopped me. And I said, I guess we're nothing. And
that moment really started me on a journey to uncover what I meant by that, because of course we're not nothing. And I think that part of the issue with the nuns right now is uncovering what it means to be a nun. And people are really starting to look at that more carefully. There's all kinds of disbelief and sort of how that manifests itself, or disaffiliation. And so I think what's really important for people is not to think of themselves as nothing, but to figure out what it is they do believe in, not talk about what they don't believe in or what they don't want to do, but talk about the values that they do hold dear. And so that's sort of, that moment sort of turned me a bit. And I think more and more people are starting to do that too.
So define yourself rather than letting others define you. You know what I mean? You're not defining yourself in terms of people who are religiously affiliated. You're looking at how you picture yourself.
Exactly. And to be, you know, I know that it's an easy term that sociologists use to call people the nuns. And I think for a while, it's been sort of lumped into one sort of monolithic piece, you know, 20% right now.
Sure.
But what's interesting is researchers are starting to tease out the variations within that category. And I think that will go a long way to helping people realize sort of what they do believe, and so that they're not always pitting themselves, you know, to be not religious is defining yourselves, you know, in a negative. Instead of doing that, embracing what you do believe. Even the word nun is a negative. So figuring out how to describe yourself.
All right. Well, let's go to our listeners, all of you. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Sure, Michelle, go ahead.
Well, it's just, I think we need to be clear that when people say they have no preference, they're not saying that they're not religious or they're not spiritual. So it's a very, if you like, a technical category that they respond, I've no denominational preference. But many of them, as I say, have traditional religious but also, you know, non-traditional spiritual beliefs. And in fact, a proportion of them attend week, or at least report attending weekly and at least monthly services. And by the same token, many of the people who are religiously affiliated don't necessarily go to church. So there's separate measures here, and of course this is the complexity of talking about religion, because it is such a dynamic, you know, environment. There are several people who identify with a religious denomination but who go to church very rarely or not at all, but they still identify. So what this new trend is, the proportion of people who do not want to identify with an established religious denomination.
And some of them say, right, Michelle, that they pray regularly,
yes,
even daily, but they still call themselves unaffiliated.
Yes, and it's really, it seems to, a lot of the data that you look at, it's really that they want to distance themselves very explicitly from religious institutions, but not from religious and spiritual beliefs in all their variety.
Okay, well, we will definitely follow up on that after a short break. Distancing themselves from religious institutions, but not necessarily spiritual practice. You can join us too, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. More on understanding the religiously unaffiliated in just a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about the rise in the religiously unaffiliated, who they are, what they believe, and why their numbers are growing. Give us a call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Michelle Dillon is with us, professor of sociology at UNH. She's written extensively about Catholicism and new religious trends. Catherine Osment is here, freelance journalist, author of a Boston Magazine article called Losing Our Religion. It's about raising her family outside of any organized church or temple. We've got a link to that article, by the way, on our website if you want to check it out. Randall Balmer is also our guest, historian, author, religion professor at Dartmouth College. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. As I suspected, folks, a lot of people want to jump in our conversation, so let's go to them. David's in Concord. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Thank you. This is David calling in. I'm on a cell phone. I hope I'll be able to stay in touch.
Sure.
This is a wonderful subject, and it encourages me in public radio. I think that your religious or spiritual experience is always based on an inner conversion, not blind faith. So I think that we're in a very wonderful time that people are seeking. There's many different ways of approaching the higher power. For example, yoga has been mentioned. Now, the very basis of yoga, even though most people focus on the hatha yoga, which is the physical part of it, is to attune the being with the super being. So you see, there's many, it's high time that people chose their spiritual concept. This is how it was done originally, through a conversion experience. It doesn't necessarily have to be in an organized religion.
So this is a positive trend, David, you feel?
Yes, this is the trend. And I'll give one more example from my own experience. Many people come into recovery, if you know what that is, who have a tremendous attitude against the higher power. But because of their own witnessing to the fact that they overcome their addictions, they have to be humble and realize that there is some higher power that helped them to do that. And that's the essence of a spiritual or religious experience.
Well, David, thank you so much for calling in. This is a really interesting point. And Randall Balmer, since you are not only a religion professor, you're also an Episcopal priest. What's your feeling about David's thought? Religious expression is based on inner conversion, not blind faith. People feel like if they join an organized group, it's more about blind faith and someone telling them what to believe.
I think there's something to that, and I would want to advocate as well that faith is not necessarily a bad thing, and in part because it separates us from the whole notion that enlightenment rationalism is the only avenue to truth or fulfillment or whatever you want to say. And I think faith is not necessarily a bad thing. But the other thing that David's comment brings to mind is the fact that we Americans are extraordinarily eclectic, particularly when it comes to religion. I used to teach at Columbia University in New York City, and I used to kind of invent this figure, someone who did Tai Chi in Central Park in the morning, consulted her horoscope in the newspaper on the way to work, prayed over lunch, did yoga when she came home from work, and attended a Presbyterian church or a Catholic church on Sunday, with no sense that there was any contradiction or that any of these expressions were mutually exclusive. And I think that's the way we Americans tend to approach faith as well as almost everything else. We're consumers, and consumers like to choose and pick and choose. And I think that's what's happening with a lot of folks these days, too.
Well, and members, Randall, of churches, synagogues, and so forth, are concerned, though, about this rise of the unaffiliated.
Sure.
I don't want to use the nuns because I know Catherine feels like it's negative, and I totally get you there, Catherine. So here's David, our caller, saying this is a great thing that people are not joining organized religion. I'm guessing people on your end say it's not so great or feel it's not so great.
Well, I'm not sure I have a dog in this fight in some ways, but I think I also have to say that I think something is lost when we turn away from organized expressions of faith. Here in New England, as you know, historically the center of the community, the building at the head of the village green, was very often the church, usually Congregational church, until it became Unitarian or something else. But in addition to being a place of religious gathering, it was also a place of social gathering. It was kind of the center of the community. And I think, I don't know how Michelle feels about this, but even in sociological terms, something is lost when we move away from organized religion, apart from religion or faith itself.
So let's follow up on that with both of you. And Michelle, you first, but Catherine, I want to ask you a question too. Randall's right, Michelle. Some research does show that belonging to a faith community is literally good for your health. Maybe it's the social connections, maybe it's the spirituality, maybe it's the slowing down once a week and taking some deep breaths. You know, people tend to have fewer heart attacks and live longer and are less depressed. I mean, there's hard evidence that shows that this is good for you.
Well, some of that evidence is mixed. I mean, I would say most people who are involved in what we would call moderate religions, mainline Protestantism and Catholicism, certainly do not have a blind faith attitude. They have faith, but they also have reason. And so, you know, as Randall said, Americans are very eclectic and they mix and match, even those, and certainly those who are affiliated, but even those who go to church every week. So it's not that they're blindly, you know, walking in line to church and believing everything they're told. That certainly hasn't been the case.
So I'm disagreeing with David's characterization there a little bit.
Yeah, but community is certainly a very important function of church.
in American society and the value of organized religion in terms of bringing people together around the rituals and unifying them, at least for an hour a week, or and just getting them to not think about all the busy things that are on their schedule, but just to be together, sharing some kind of faith and giving praise to whatever it is that they believe in. But on the other hand, I don't think we should get too nostalgic about the loss of community, because that's another big theme that we hear a lot about in the media. Certainly, some traditional forms of community have declined, not surprisingly, as a result of changes in our society. You know, more women out at work. You know, increased urbanization, increased use of internet, and all kinds of other things that have changed what we would normally have thought of as traditional community. But most Americans are still finding community. They're finding that in different ways. So some still find community at church, but many are finding it in their yoga group or in their biking group or something else. So it's certainly something that we have to watch for and see the impact of if fewer, and this would be identifying, but also going to church, how is that going to impact the role of churches as structures of community? But just because one structure collapses or declines in importance doesn't mean that there aren't other, maybe less formally organized, but nonetheless important of community attachment.
And Catherine, I definitely want to ask you about this, but Michelle, so does the research say it's more about community? Do faith communities have this health benefit more than other communities, or is your Saturday morning yoga group just as good?
I think you have to look at it at the individual level.
Yeah.
I mean, some of my own research looking at people over the course of their lives and following the same people over their life course showed that certainly for those who had a long-term investment or attachment to religious practice ended up having good lives, but we also found that those who were completely secular also had very meaningful and purposeful lives. So, you know, I know some of that data that you're thinking about, and it makes a good headline. You know, go to church, live longer, but it is a little
right.
more complicated.
Sure. And Catherine, I know you have thoughts on this. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say that I think the community aspect is something that a lot of people who disaffiliate from religion really miss. And what's kind of interesting, a trend that's going on right now, is the growth of non-religious values-based groups. So this is going beyond a biking group or, you know, a book club, but something like a secular humanist organization, or there are now these Sunday assemblies, which have been dubbed atheist churches. And the whole point of them is really to get people together in a way that churches and temples do, to think about their values and to give back to the community. They often organize volunteer activities. But, you know, belief in a supernatural power or any kind of affiliation with religion is optional. So you can really come in with, you know, whatever you've got, and they will welcome you. And you can be part of, and I experienced when I lived in Cambridge, the Harvard Humanist Community is a wonderful organization. And I brought my kids to all kinds of volunteer activities that I couldn't have really put together myself, you know, from my own home. But here they are, a structure like religion that kind of gets you into the flow of charitable giving. So that was a great value from that organization. And they have regular Sunday gatherings. And so I think people are seeking out new and creative ways to have that, because a lot of times, you know, honestly, we go to a yoga class, we do the exercises, and then we leave and we don't talk to anyone. So I think that what people are really seeking is more a sense of belonging. And they're trying to find that outside of religion.
All right, lots of calls. Yeah, go ahead, Randall.
May I say, that's not entirely a new thing. The Ethical Cultural Society was begun in the 19th century, as I'm sure both of the guests know.
Right.
And that's a kind of a prototypical humanist sort of organization that has, curiously to me, has religious overtones in the sense of ritual and so forth, but it also provides a community, as you were saying.
Well, so what about the Unitarians,
sure.
Randall? I mean, is that what the Unitarians sprang from?
Not really. The Ethical Culture Society was more a kind of secular Jewish organization, not entirely, but the organizers were secular Jews. In the case of Unitarianism, that is more a move. Unitarianism actually is a lineal descendant from Puritanism, oddly enough, and it became popular in the early part of the 19th century, in large part because of its affiliations or affinities with Enlightenment rationalism.
All right. Tons of people who want to jump in our conversation. Let's go to Christopher in Lebanon. Hi, Christopher. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. How are you today?
Great.
Like I told the other lady, I was raised Catholic. I went to Catholic schools. I still believe in God. I just can't follow the Catholic ruling anymore. My brother is gay. He came out to my family, and we all very much support him. And under the new pope, that might change, that they don't respect homosexuals. But until everybody falls behind the current pope and the rules change, I can't support a church that doesn't support my family.
Christopher, there are a lot of Protestant churches that are, you know, open, welcoming, whoever you are. You know, they've got their rainbow flags out in front and so forth. Why don't you go to a Protestant church? You could still be Christian, but your brother would be accepted.
You know, like I said, I went to Catholic school. I was brought into Catholicism. So I don't like this concept that, well, this God supports this and that God supports that. So they're all one God in my mind. So I have a hard time going to different churches because, you know, if I look far enough into different religions, I'm sure I'll find stuff about them that I'm not fond of, to be perfectly frank.
Okay. Well, Christopher, thank you for calling in. This is a really important point. And Michelle Dillon, you're a scholar on these issues of the Catholic Church. Go ahead.
Yes, well, I totally understand what Christopher is saying, and I should say that, you know, the majority of American Catholics share his opinion, but many of them still decide to identify as Catholic and to go to church, because American Catholicism, at least since the late 1960s, early 70s, why it has remained as visible as it is in part because large numbers of Catholics say that they make up their own minds about sexual morality issues. And at the same time, they will value aspects of the faith and the ritual and the sacraments. And that really is just, that's what it means to be an American Catholic. For most people, it's to disagree with the Vatican on its sexual teachings. And indeed, many openly gay Catholics go to Catholic churches, and many have found, as they will tell you in interviews, local parishes that are actually very affirming of them. Now, I know that doesn't change. I mean, obviously, the official teaching is still marginalizing of them, and I totally understand what Christopher is saying about that. But nonetheless, many seem to be able to negotiate a local Catholic religious life that doesn't expect them to deny their sexuality.
I see. So even though the Pope and the leaders of the Vatican may say one thing, you're saying at the local parish level, Michelle, there's diversity of thought.
Yes, but not at every. I mean, obviously, you have to go looking, but not every parish is affirming. But certainly, many gay Catholics do find locally inclusive parishes.
Well, Christopher, it's great to hear from you. Thank you for calling in. Did somebody else want to jump in there?
Randall,
go ahead.
I think Christopher's comments underscore something, and Michelle mentioned it as well, that is very important in this phenomenon. That is a suspicion of institutions. When people say, for example, I'm spiritual, I'm not religious, what they mean, I think, most of them, is that they're very suspicious of institutional forms of religion. And I think I understand that, I think with good reason. And I think that suspicion goes all the way back to the 1960s when we as Americans became suspicious of institutions generally during the Vietnam War and especially during Watergate. And with the Catholic Church, to the turning point by all sociological evidence, and I expect that Michelle would concur with this, was Pope Paul VI's Humanae Vitae encyclical about birth control. And that's what gave many American Catholics in particular permission to say, I disagree with the Pope, but I'm still a good Catholic.
Well, and on that note, we have an email from Matthew who says, it seems like this is related to the general mistrust of larger organizations in America these days, of the government, of large corporations, and extending to religious organizations as well. Matthew says, people might still have faith, but don't want to be associated with some behemoth that might be seen as trying to tell them how to live their lives, especially where those religions might directly conflict with their modern social morals, especially regarding sexuality or reproductive rights, among others. So there's Matthew relating exactly to what our caller says and to what you say, Randall. Let's go to Heartland, Vermont. Derek is calling from there. Hi, Derek. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Basically, I've come to the conclusion that the subject of belief in God or not is really kind of a distraction. We have a world that is clearly in crisis in a lot of ways, many of which have been created by differences in religion. And what it boils down to, it seems to me, that we have the opportunity to try to change things if we can put the religion aside and just concentrate on the things that need to be done in order to first perhaps bring peace and bring a cleaner.
Well, Derek, you're from Heartland. You're from Vermont, which, as we said, is the least religious state in the nation. Where do you fall down religiously?
I don't believe that it's important whether there's a God or not.
Okay. Thanks for calling in, Derek.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Here's an email that came in from David in Essex, Massachusetts. He says, though conflating faith and belief into a word with a shared definition is common, David says these terms are not actually synonymous. When the guest said kids aren't signing on to their parents' faith, what is really happening is that kids aren't signing up for their parents' beliefs. As you indicated, they have faith in God, even as you note, a Jewish or Christian one. David says Jesus himself made this dichotomy. He never said your beliefs have made you well. It was always your faith has made you well. David, thanks for that email. Here's another email that came in. This is from Christopher in Manchester. Can we draw a parallel between older places in northern climates and this trend? I recently read that some northern European countries like Germany and France have become almost totally secular. Michelle, can you address that? Northern Europe, Northern New England, both quite secular.
Well, yes, Northern Europe is highly secular, but again, it's secular in terms of organized religion. There's evidence there for the last 20 years or so of increasing appreciation for, you know, spiritual beliefs and appreciation for some kind of higher power. And so, in fact, even there you see this, it's spiritual independent of institutionalized established traditions. So I don't know whether it's related to the weather. I think there's a shared, some shared factor, certainly. But it's not just me. I know we talk about the difference of, you know, New Hampshire and Vermont, but it's really the whole of the Northeast that is less religious, it's more secular. And in part here in the U.S., it's largely because the original religious traditions, or at least in relative recent history, have been, as we've said, the mainline moderate traditions, which in themselves are not as intense in people's everyday life as,
right,
for example,
as Randall said earlier.
Traditions.
Yeah. Yep. All right. More after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Today, we're looking at the increase in religiously unaffiliated people at this deeply religious time of year for some other folks. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Would you call yourself religiously unaffiliated? Are you part of the none-of-the-above group when it comes to religion? Why? What's good about it, in your opinion? Also, if you are part of an organized faith community, what's your reaction to the increase in people who would sign off as none of the above? Again, join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Michelle Dillon, Catherine Osment, Randall Balmer, let's go right back to our listeners. Katrina's calling from Bow. Hi, Katrina, you're on The Exchange. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on, and a very wonderful topic at this time of year. You know, in listening to your guests and the other callers, I found myself thinking of the comment, I think, associated with Socrates, that the unexamined life is not worth living. And I think for many people, certainly for myself, part of that examination involved, you know, certain fundamental questions that most people do wrestle with at some point in their lives. You know, who am I? Where do I come from? What's the purpose of life? And I think for many people, they also have a question, where am I going? And it is, I think, in seeking answers to those very, very deep and quite universal questions that many people are led to some sort of path of faith and some sort of path of organized religion. But what strikes me in both listening to some of the callers and the observations of your guests is that what's different about the time we're living in is perhaps less of a willingness on the part of people to follow that inquiry wherever it may lead. You know, I think there is more of a sense of, well, I start out with this set of views or this set of convictions, and I need to find something that fits that. And that's a somewhat different posture. I think that might, in a way, explain the dramatic rise in the unaffiliated, that, you know, rather than viewing this kind of inquiry for truth as something that will lead them somewhere, they are seeking something that fits sort of the framework that they have devised for themselves.
So it sounds like, Katrina, you're saying they're taking the easy path.
You know, that you know, I think one could say that. I think it is definitely a different approach. It's one thing to say, I'm starting out on this inquiry, and even if it leads me in places that, you know, might ask changes of me in my lifestyle or might, you know, cause me to assess my own choices or behavior in such a way that I say, I have to change, I think people are more inclined to say, you know, I will find beliefs that fit what feels comfortable to me. And you know, those are two different worlds, the worlds of people who say sometimes truth makes us uncomfortable and that's a good thing and it's supposed to, and people who perhaps feel differently.
Well, Katrina, thank you for calling in. And Catherine, what do you think about Katrina's comment that organized religion helps you wrestle with these uncomfortable but very fundamental questions of life? Who am I? Where am I going?
Well, I can see what she's talking about because there's definitely more of an individualistic urge, you know, as people kind of fan out and go in their own direction to figure out, you know, where they're going. But what I keep seeing and what I keep, you know, meeting people doing is really honestly searching their own hearts, searching their own communities. I don't see people, you know, deciding that they're not going to go on that quest. I just see people doing it in a different way than, say, their parents or grandparents have. And what I find, you know, increasingly, so I come from a Christian background. My husband comes from a Jewish background. Our kids are growing up with a little bit of both, and I think more and more families are having to do that, and it actually opens possibilities. I don't think it shuts them down. When my kids ask what happens when we die, I tell them what I believe, but I say, you know, but your aunt believes something completely different, and you should talk to her about that because she could tell you something else. You know, I don't think my mother's mother would have told her that. Mm. I think she would have said, we believe this, and you will believe that. And so in some ways, I think the possibilities are more open for many of us than they were in the past. So I actually get what she's talking about with that individualistic, you know, urge. But the people I'm meeting, what's happening in my own family is very much a search and not looking for easy answers.
So the search is, you're saying, broadened by this openness to other ideas and other traditions.
I think so, yeah, and I think, you know, in many families are blended in so many different ways than they were in the past, and religion is just another aspect of it, you know. You now at Thanksgiving, you might have an atheist at the table, and you can hear what they have to say, and people are kind of coming out and sharing more of their perspective, and I just think that that's a good thing.
I want to ask all of you, I think you first, Michelle Dillon, about a narrative that's been out there for a long time concerning organized religion and see if it's still true. So here it is, Michelle. The typical narrative about people falling off with their faith, so to speak, is this. People grow up with their family's religion, then they leave for college, they get out of the habit, they start not really caring, they start sleeping in on Sundays, then they have kids and they go back to church or temple. Now, is that still the case?
Well, that certainly used to be the case, and but that's no longer the case, in part because the factors that propelled people to return to church up until the 1970s and into the 80s have themselves become unstable. So, you know, younger people today, the people in their 20s and 30s, who happen, as we've talked, happen actually to be more likely to be unaffiliated than older age groups, you know, they're postponing marriage, they're postponing having children, the job situation, their career paths are very different from even people in their 20s 20 years ago. So all the, you know, religion doesn't exist independent of everything else in society. And so today's social world, particularly for people in their 20s and 30s, is, I think, qualitatively different than some of the patterns we would have seen even, as I say, 20 years ago for a similar age group. And so those are the triggers that can push people back to institutionalized religion. And these triggers themselves are a little bit on hold.
That's interesting. Randall, you wrote about this too. Go ahead. Younger adults and how they may not be returning to religion, quote unquote, as much as they might have in past decades.
I think that's right. I think there are all sorts of new options out there. And as several of the guests have said, different ways of building community. I understand that. And I'd like to just shift a little bit and talk about why people do come back. It's not only because of kids, but life is tough. And none of us gets out without bruises. that's part of what it means to live. And I think at times of crisis, many people still go towards some form of organized faith, whether it's returning to the faith of their childhood or it's seeking new expressions of faith to help them through difficult circumstances, health problems, the loss of a partner or a spouse or loved one. And that does bring people back, I think, even if temporarily to the faith. And that still happens.
Catherine, what did you see around you among your cohorts? Did you see this narrative playing out or not so much?
Of people going back.
Right, once they had children.
And I think that's I'm part of this, you know, world in which religion really isn't in the air that most of the people I know breathe. And I think that's part of it, is we're just not really talking about it, and we're not, we don't know a lot of people who are doing it, and so it's easy to slip away and not go back because there's not any societal pressure. You know, as you talk about northern New England, also the Pacific Northwest, in certain parts of the country, you know, you might be the oddball if you were going to religious services. So there's not, like, you know, that kind of pressure that would get you to go back in. And for most of the people I know, they really are kind of stuck in a kind of stasis. They feel a longing for that, and they want it for their kids. They want the community. They want all the rituals. But like the earlier caller, they can't buy into the institution, and so they can't quite get them through the door of the place. And so I think it's a really difficult place to be, and I think the most important thing for those people is to kind of figure out, well, what do you believe in, and start with that and see if you can find a community that reflects that. You know, it doesn't have to be a religious one. It could be a non-religious community. But if you're missing some of those things, you can try to find them. And I think that that's important to know at this time.
Let's take another call. This is Lisa in Hooksett. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. I have a couple quick points. Your guest failed to mention education as being very important. And the Northeast and the Pacific Northwest are full of highly educated people, and education often leads to questioning and further thought about your life and the world. And I think that's one reason why people let their religion go. And also, my whole life, I've always wondered how people could inherit a religion from their families. It's not an eye color or a hair color. It's a belief. So, yes, your family can have traditions, but I don't understand why I've never understood why it was such a big deal that if you came from a Catholic family that you had to be Catholic. It just never made any sense to me. Myself, I am non-religious. I have children. They're growing up to be responsible, decent human beings with good morals and values. I have never brought them to church. I have gone to church like twice in my life, and I'm a very empathetic, decent human being. I give to charities that are not religiously affiliated. I just don't think that you need to belong to anything to be a good human being and a good person with good values.
I think that's absolutely right.
And thanks for calling, Lisa. Go ahead, Randall. Yeah.
Of course, that's absolutely right. That's manifestly true. But I think the pressure in terms of the generational transfer of faith is felt by the parents, not by the kids. The parents want to pass their faith on, or at least many of them want to pass their faith on to their children, in part because, as I said earlier, they know that life is tough, and at some point they may need that. The other important thing we really haven't talked about in this conversation is the importance of understanding morality and having some grasp on moral formation. Now, I entirely agree that you don't have to be religious to be a moral person. That's absolutely the case. But I think a lot of parents believe that having a religious foundation provides at least something to push against for their children as they grow up and become moral beings. The point about education, I just want to address that very quickly. And the latest Pew survey indicates that the correlation between education and non-religion, it may not be as great as we had thought. And so I'd be careful about making that assertion.
Right. Oh, okay. Yeah, Michelle, do you want to jump in there?
I mean, in fact, there's a lot of data historically and certainly still currently that there isn't a strong relation between that the more educated you are, that the more likely you are to be disaffiliated.
Well, it's interesting, and we've got an email here actually from Jack who talks about that. So let me share it with you. Jack says, religious leaders used to be respected for their intellectual and scholarly achievements as well as for their piety and devotion to God and God's creation. Jack says, today it is fashionable for intellectuals to be skeptics, agnostics, even atheists. Jack says, as a Catholic, I've often heard people say that they were, quote, raised Catholic, implying that they have since outgrown the faith that nurtured the likes of Augustine, Aquinas, Sir Thomas More, John Paul the Great, etc. Jack says we need to be more skeptical of our own skepticism, our own intelligence, the age in which we live, and the conventional wisdom, which is what everybody thinks, everybody else thinks. So there's Jack jumping in on those two points. Here's Anthony who emails. He says, I would argue that the Appalachian Mountain Club is a lot of, quote, naturally spirited peoples toward organized religion. So Jack, thank you for that. Anthony, thank you for that. Michelle, did you want to jump in there again?
No, I would just say that certainly people, there's many resources that people can use today. This is the point made earlier. And I think one of the things that our young people have accessed more than probably their parents was to a greater legitimacy, a greater range of what are seen as legitimate resources from diverse traditions. So whether it's Eastern traditions, whether it's traditional, you know, Western traditions. But there's this eclecticism that we've mentioned that really gives people permission to delve into a variety of traditions and a variety of sources and experiences in order to find truth. And I would say truth with probably a small t rather than a capital T. But people are seeking to live good lives, and the idea that you have to go to church in order to learn morality, that still matters to many people, but there's also a recognition that it's the practice of what it is that you believe, how that matters in your everyday life.
And that's our caller Lisa's point, is that she's not religiously affiliated, but she believes she, you know, works to make the world a better place, so to speak.
Right.
Catherine Osmond, I have a question for you. Again, I mentioned this Boston Magazine article, Losing Our Religion. We've got a link to our website. You're now going to be writing a book about this same topic. What are you going to be teasing out for people in this book? Give us a little taste there, if you could.
Sure. So I'm looking at the sort of what is lost when we walk away from religion, the one that we were raised with, and what we can do to replace any aspects of that. And it's a tricky question to answer, because you can't replace religion, obviously. It is a powerful force. It is a place that's sort of like a one-stop shop for all kinds of things. You can go there, you know, on Sunday, and you get so much. But the question is, what are people today doing to make up for that, if they do feel a loss or a lack in their lives? And so I'm looking at different ways that people are creating their own secular rituals. At this time of year, a lot of interfaith families do all kinds of different things to celebrate the holidays. There's also a big movement to celebrate the solstice, for example. And so people are starting to be creative and figure out ways that they can express their values differently than in their traditions from the past, while also bringing some pieces of that in. Looking at ways that people are finding meaning without God, ways that they figure out how to create meaning instead of find it. Also looking at different communities. So there are, for example, these wonderful storytelling communities, and I looked at one out in the Pacific Northwest where people get together and they share their stories from their lives that were very moving and transformative. And they do it, oddly enough, in the synagogue in town, because it's the biggest place that'll fit all the people. And the rabbi sits in the front seat. He loves this event. He brings, you know, he tells all his congregants to come. And as a result of this community, some people who come for the storytelling have now joined the temple. People from the temple are now big storytellers. So there's sort of this interesting flow, I think, back and forth. So I'm really looking at this dynamic sort of change that's going on.
All right. Well, all of you, this has been great. Thank you so much for taking time out to be with us. Catherine Osment, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That's Catherine Osment, freelance journalist, author of a Boston Magazine article called Losing Our Religion. You can check it out on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Michelle Dillon, always good to have you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Laura. My pleasure.
Michelle Dillon, professor of sociology at UNH. She's written extensively about Catholicism and new religious trends. And Randall Balmer, thank you also for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Laura. Thank you.
Randall Balmer, historian, author, religion professor at Dartmouth College. His latest book is Redeemer, The Life of Jimmy Carter. There is still time for you to vote on the best exchange shows of 2014. The voting's underway right now. on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Here's what's going on. We want to play back our best of 2014 programs for you over the last week of December. We'd love your input. We've put up our staff's top 10 picks. You can vote for your favorites. The polls, so to say, close on Sunday night. So go to nhpr.org/exchange. and help us select the best exchange shows of 2014. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producer is Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. And I'm Laura Kanoy.